Meetings for Wednesday, February 6th. Good afternoon. Open a work session on Senate Bill 5556 for the purpose of taking information from the Department of Education.
Can we work together?
Okay, just one minute.
That's fine. Sorry. We're opening instead a work session in order to take a report. Not yet on Senate Bill 5566. I'm just so excited about that one, I got ahead of myself. Good afternoon, folks. Staff want to lead off?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The first thing I wanted to let you know is that, as you found when you first sat down today, there's actually a replacement of the document that the department provided. They had inadvertently left a page out. So out of the first document, there was two pages. It was supposed to be three. They have provided us with that.
And we all knew that.
Yes.
We noticed it when we read it.
As a representative of the timber industry, I thank you for giving five pages and stuff.
Anything else? Co-chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, I'm Sue McGlashan, Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Finance and Administration at the Oregon Department of Education. And with me today is Dr. Nancy Montini, Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. And we are here today to provide you with an update on a budget note from the 2007 legislative session that directed the department to do further analysis on the viability of co-locating the Oregon School for the Blind and the Oregon School for the Deaf on the campus for the School for the Deaf. And I'd also like to introduce Bruce Murray. Mr. Murray is a former executive vice president with Bank of America and former real estate director for Chicago Public Schools. And he served on a site panel that was convened by Innovation Partnership to examine the consolidation issue. And there are essentially two components to this budget note. One relates to our issuing an RFP, or a request for a proposal, for the cost of the needed changes to the OSD campus to accommodate the OSB population. And then the other component relates to discussions with potential buyers of the OSB property. And the agency has been working primarily on the portion of the budget note related to developing the RFP for the legislature's review. And our focus so far has been on gathering information to ensure a successful RFP process. So what have we done? We have collected information from service providers regarding needed services for the blind and visually impaired in order to guide program design and delivery structure on a co-located campus. We have received input from Innovation Partnerships panel of school and other real estate experts regarding current utilization of the sites, the potential for co-location, the changes that would be needed to accommodate both student populations, and recommendations for a development process. And then to further inform this process, we have engaged the Oregon Audits Division to do a risk assessment at both schools on a variety of areas, and that includes campus safety, meeting the needs of students, and then managing the co-location planning process. And finally, we've asked the Oregon State Police to conduct a safety assessment. And if we have time today, Dr. Latini can provide more detail on these assessments if you wish. And I do want to note that the RFP has not yet been developed for your review, and we thought that that would be somewhat premature given that the site panel is recommending that we proceed first with what they are calling an RFQ, or request for quotation, and we would call this an RFI, a request for information. And since we have a number of items on the agenda today, what I'd like to do now is turn it over to Mr. Murray so that he can provide you with more detail on the site panel's work and recommendations.
Yeah, what I thought I'd do, if it's okay with everybody, was just highlight some of the conclusions that we came to as a result of our review of the materials and our visit to the respective sites in December. First, I should emphasize that the site panel we formed it from a pool of volunteer real estate experts. And that pool we select each panel in accordance with the needs of a specific issue that we've been asked to address.
Mr. Murray, before you get too far ahead, we need on the tape your name and just for the record.
It's Bruce Murray, M-U-R-R-A-Y.
Thanks.
Regarding the schools for the blind and the deaf, the site panel was engaged to examine the consolidation of both programs onto one campus, the impact of this consolidation on facilities and site plan issues, to review the appraisal of the Oregon School for the Blind site and other value funding issues, and to make recommendations for a future development process. Our conclusions came under several categories. First, under operational options, we stated that if one accepts the assumption that the residential school model is retained for approximately today's student population, the panel concurs with the relocation of the School for the Blind facilities to the School for the Deaf campus. This would allow optimal shared use, operating civic savings, and the rehabilitation and use of existing buildings. We toured the sites and we reviewed the OTAC report dated February 2007, where they in turn revised their master plan from the early 90s, and we made several recommendations with respect to the use of the facilities and the construction of new facilities on the School for the Deaf campus. I'll skip over those for the moment for brevity. The panel believed that the cost of the recommended changes may well be less than the OTAC estimate, given the decreased reliance on new construction and given the likely efficiencies and creativity of a developer-led design and construction process. Regarding value realization, we had several conclusions. The panel believed that the sale of the School for the Blind site may in fact realize 1.5 to 2 times the appraisal that was conducted about a year ago. While the appraisal certainly was properly done, the large size of this site and its proximity to two expanding institutional users may argue for upward adjustments to the comparables, not downward, in our opinion. A carefully managed developer-led process may maximize the sales proceeds. The panel also recommended that a model be developed which includes all costs incidental to relocation of the School for the Blind facilities. We also think that the consolidation of the two campuses should result in significant operating cost savings. The panel believes that it is reasonable for the Department of Education to request additional funds for the consolidation in an amount equal to 5 or 6 times these savings. This additional investment will facilitate operating efficiencies and will be recovered in a short payback period. We also stated that we believe that the funds available from the School for the Blind site, from a reasonable multiple of the operating savings, and from the sale of possible residual excess land at the School for the Deaf campus, may well recover the total cost of the consolidation. Regarding the development process, the panel strongly believes that an experienced real estate developer needs to be selected through an RFQ process to lead and manage the consolidation process. A qualified developer can bring significant value by establishing a dialogue with all parties regarding their wish list while managing and coordinating all consultants and contractors, finding solutions consistent with resources and objectives, and maximizing sales proceeds. The panel estimated the whole process may take up to 4 years, 2 years for developer selection, planning, design, and entitlement, and another 2 years to complete constructions. So those are some of the highlights of the conclusions from our work. And obviously, we're going to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Thank you, Madam Board Chair. I was wondering if they did a survey of the staff primarily. Did you have to do a survey of the students and the student families, what they thought was most important?
That wasn't part of the panel's engagement.
Co-chair is Senator Bates. My name is Nancy Latini. In response to your question about the survey, we did a survey not just of staff, we did it of school administrators, school teachers. Some families did respond. We have a 20% rate that said other, and I wish that we didn't have that choice so we'd know who they were. Yeah, but the students were not asked at this point yet. And these are questions. The questions we asked in this survey had to do with what services would they really need at the School for the Blind versus what services can serve students who are visually impaired or blind in your school district. And we were not surprised at some of the findings. I think in our first round of studies, we saw the same thing. And schools can adequately supply services in general education curriculum. They cannot supply the specialty training, mobility training, or the special skill development transition, getting ready for adult life. And those are the things we wanted to know about when, if there was a co-location, we wanted to make sure we set the program up to meet the needs of the students and the families and the administrators and teachers who asked that question.
The comment is, this is an outsider, and I don't know what the curriculum there is like, what the needs are, but it would seem logical to ask the students and the student families, especially when you have a declining population, what do you need, what works best for you, for your family, and the needs of your child as they grow up, not just ask the staff. I don't get it. I was thinking there.
Senator? Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Nolan. So did you, in your evaluation, did you look at and consider the current adequacy of the buildings and the curricula in the two schools as far as we're talking about here, perhaps another 4 years before this problem is resolved? Is the current situation adequate and safe?
Yes, it is. I mean, I think, you know, people are doing, the maintenance staff is doing a very good job of maintaining the buildings as well as they can, given the resources, right, and given the age of the buildings. So, yes, I think, we think they could, I'll use the word advisedly, but limp along, I mean, you know, manage through this process with some, you know, careful maintenance, but I think they could.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Winters.
Thank you. Just a question, because you mentioned 2 years for the development, or to get a developer process. Can you shed some light on why it would take 2 years for that process? I know when you get into building why that would take 2 years, but why would it take 2 years in order to get the master developer?
I can't speak for how long it might take this to go through the selection process, but once that's done, I think we do need to allow time for, you know, careful consideration and conversation regarding, you know, the cohabitation issues, the safety issues. You know, you need to carefully evaluate how many and how we can reuse existing facilities that are on the deaf campus. And get careful cost estimates. If we just charge ahead, I'd be concerned about controlling the cost and, you know, coming within whatever budget is agreed to.
Maybe I'll ask it a different way. Is the DASC, which has, are they involved in assisting you, working with you on this particular issue?
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Winters, not at this point.
And do you plan to get them involved, and if you do, when?
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Winters, certainly as we move along, if it's appropriate for DASC to be involved, but I can't tell you at this point exactly when that would be.
I ask that because often, you know, we do have an entity that works on the very issues that you're describing, and I'd hate to see us, you know, going off one pathway where we utilize the resources that currently exist.
Thank you, Senator. Good point. Senator Schrader?
So when do we see the numbers? I mean, I like what I hear, I think, but I mean, I guess I would like to know the way the budget note's worded. We have an opportunity to get this on the road, certainly before we walk in the door in 09. And so the question would be, you know, when do we see the comparison of costs of operations now, anticipated reductions over time, the consolidation you talked about, the potential for the land sales, how the costs will be recovered? When do we actually get to see that?
Madam Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, we don't have a specific date for you. What we would like is your acknowledgement that it would be wiser to use this RFI or RFQ process at this point before we enter into the RFP process, and we can certainly provide you information for how long that would take and then how long we think the RFQ process would take and give you an idea of when you would be able to see the numbers.
So if I may, Madam,
sir,
two questions. Go into more detail about why the RFI versus just getting the job done as per Senator Winters. And then the other would be, let's have a set time. You know, that before we walk out of here in February, maybe you could give us some pretty good target dates at least to expect a report.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, my understanding from my contract officer, and I'm not a contract expert, but with an RFP process, you already know what you want, and you're putting a solicitation out there that results in, you know, a contract. With the RFI process, you have some need for information. That's why it's called a request for information, and you're trying to find out things like, you know, ability to deliver and market information and other things to inform your decision. But I would ask Mr. Murray to talk about why they think, in particular, the RFQ process would be the better way to go. They're calling it an RFQ process.
Yeah, and I will not pretend to be knowledgeable on how, especially the state of Oregon, how we go about going through these processes. But I think it is very important in response to is that this lead person, lead company, developer, whatever phrase, is selected such that they can coordinate and referee the whole process. You know, as an ex-banker, yeah, the numbers are all important, you know, before you put a shovel in the ground and to see if it makes sense. But there needs to be a knowledgeable entity coordinating this process and arriving at that budget number.
If I may, ma'am.
Yes, sir.
So what you're asking for is rather than just some low-cost bid process out there, you're trying to do like a lot of the engineering firms would like us to do for state and local government in general, which is have a set of criteria against which you're going to measure qualified companies, and they'll give you their best proposals based on, gets to Senator Bates' question about the quality of the system. It's not just about building a building. It's about the quality of the system. Is that accurate reflection?
Madam Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, I believe so. We know that we don't have the expertise at the department to do this in-house, and we need somebody who's going to help us ask the right questions and know what to ask and what should be, you know, part of the RFP. And so it's kind of the precursor, as I think of it in my mind, the precursor to that RFP process, to make sure that when we put that request out there, we're asking for the right thing. So I hope that helps. Again, I'm not a contract expert.
So my final comment, if I may, Madam.
That's fine. Senator?
So, like, again, before we leave in February, I'm willing to, the sense of the body on that is, we'll take that in a minute, but I would like to have some pretty clear guidelines for our fiscal staff about when to expect the RFQ process to be done, when the RFP will be done, or whatever the use of quality to the RFQ process is done. And I would ask that you keep the committee engaged before you get the professional. I think it's wise personally to have a professional head this up. But before you get too far down the line, you should check with people that are concerned about cost, i.e. us, before you get too far down the line, if that's okay.
Good suggestion. That's fine. That's good. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you'll allow me, I'm going to continue to channel Senator Schrader.
That's scary.
I think that for some of us who have observed government contracting, some of the concerns are the devil's in the details. For example, one would expect that if you undertake a contracting process like this, that the idea would be to minimize per square foot costs, to find the greatest efficiency, to minimize the potential of change orders. If you are setting out sort of guiding philosophical principles and asking companies to respond with their qualifications, I would hope that you would have very little tolerance for change orders. And I guess I'm looking for your response on that. I worked in a Great Lakes state agency for 5 years, and I saw contracts changed over and over and over and over again, and they were never lowered because of efficient, capable performance.
I see this process, I think we see this process resulting in the selection of a lead entity which evaluates the various alternatives between new construction and rehabilitation, evaluates and listens to each of the constituencies regarding the cohabitation issues, and all of the issues that are, you know, mentioned in this report and other reports, and then comes up with, in their opinion, their expertise, you know, the most effective cost solution, and then you go out and have bids. Then you go out and engage a contractor. Then you go out and engage an architect. This is more, you know, I don't know what the right word is, but, you know, drawing the puzzle before you put it together or whatever.
And I guess my only comment would be, when you undertake it, and I'm comforted by what you say, but as you undertake that process, then you get down at some point where you figure out the square foot cost.
Right.
And when it comes in at $1,800 a square foot, and obviously that's hyperbolic, but then you've got all of this past history, and you reach these sort of crisis points where you can't go back because you spent all this money, and you can't go forward very well. I think just not seeing a huge construction surprise would be one thing that would comfort the legislature.
And, you know, in my 25 years as a banker, that's what I lived in fear of, too, was those surprises. And if the entity selected is doing its job right, there shouldn't be a surprise. You know, there's going to be some new construction, and that can have fixed cost contracts to bid it. There will be some rehabilitation work. We all know that rehabilitation work, you don't get a fixed price contract, you know, and there's risk. But if it's assessed right, designed right, again, I can never promise you none, but it should be minimal.
Thank you.
I applaud the thoughtful process and the business-like approach. However, the glacial speed of this business-like approach is disturbing. We know from the OHSU buildings that the cost of construction is going up 8 to 12% a year. If we take the high end of that, in 4 years, this project will cost 150% of what it would cost today. So, as I said, I applaud the business-like approach, but I think we need to accelerate this thing and perhaps prioritize it and get it done. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm referring to this document, the State Schools Update piece, which was the back page of which I think was the missing page. And I'm going to read this paragraph, and I'm hopeful. I've looked at a lot of financial proposals, but that you can help me understand this. Consolidation of the two campuses should result in significant operating cost savings. That seems clear. The panel believes that it is reasonable for the Oregon Department of Education to request additional funds for the consolidation in an amount equal to 5 to 6 times these savings. Can you help me with is that a return on equity? I mean, yeah, explain it, that.
Exactly. It's that straightforward is right. If you could spend $500,000 to save $500,000 a year, you know, I think most of us would say that's, you know, well worth considering. So it's, you know, so if you can save $100,000 a year, you know, by doing certain things, we would say it's well worth considering spending up $500,000 to $600,000 to save that $100,000 a year.
Brief follow-up, please.
Yes, Representative.
I'm hopeful in the report, the short payback period, that'll be described.
Mm-hmm.
Because
that's
short.
5 to 6 years, right, yeah.
Okay, it is somewhat relative. And it goes on to say, the panel believes the funds available from the sale of the site plus the other land may well cover the total cost.
Correct.
Is that, and I know we've talked about, we don't have all the numbers yet, but is that... There are no numbers here. What is the total cost? And
well, the numbers that we looked at, that we had in hand when we had conducted the site plan in December were the OTAC numbers, I believe, are 16 to 17 million. There was the appraisal on the school for the blind site, recognizing that the panel believed that appraisal, that the realized proceeds, in fact, could be in excess of that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take the land sales proceeds, you take this multiplier, if you so choose to go that route, you know, on the cost savings, you put those two together as your sources, you line that up versus how much money you're going to spend to reconfigure and rehabilitate the school in the Duff campus, we think there's a good chance there'll be a match. It may not, you know. I mean, this is our estimates from one day at work, but our guesstimates would be even a better word. But that's what I think this RFQ process and the selection of the developer will in fact determine over the next few months.
Let me try to get a summarize the sense I'm getting here, and you all can tell me if I'm picking up on the message I should be picking up. I'm sensing that the committee wants a bit more information before we're prepared to answer the question you've asked us, Ms. McGlashan, about whether we support the RFQ process. And Senator Schrader has suggested to you that we'd like that information from you before we adjourn this session. So my question to you would be, what information could you have to us by the end of next week or the first of the following week that would inform that decision? And then I'll ask the committee if that would be agreeable then to ask them to come back for a very brief conversation, because our agenda gets pretty busy then. But I don't think you'd get a very positive answer to your question today.
Ms. McClellan. Madam Chair, the OTAC report to which Mr. Murray referred, that, as he said, indicated, given the assumptions in that report, that the cost to renovate the OSD campus to accommodate the OSB students would be about $16-17 million. And I believe that the Innovation Partnership Panel believes those costs could actually come down. The appraisal that was done on OSB's campus, albeit a conservative one, and again, properly done, was for, I believe, $9 million. So if you're looking at, in reality, 1.5 to 2 times that, you're looking at, what, $13.5 to $18 million. So if that gives you a sense, I hope that gives you a sense of some of the costs, but we can certainly come back with some numbers on paper for you.
More specifically, could you also come back with the timeline that Senator Schrader has asked for? So, committee members, would that be useful for you?
Madam Chair, it would be. The other thing that would be useful, and that's whether or not they already have a list of individuals that could provide the the PFQ process, because it would seem to me if you're talking about working with some entity out there, you have some kind of idea of who those individuals and that entity is.
Senator Bates?
Thank you, Madam Kutcher. I'm still very concerned about this whole project, not from the point of view of balancing out what's going to cost for bricks and mortar to put a new building together, but some bigger issues in this. There are some changes coming, or may not be coming, in treatment for these individuals and things available to them from technology, everything from cochlear implants to aids in vision and others. And we're looking at something we have apparently some kind of a declining population. The population may be declining into a group that really needs intensive help, while others are being treated in their communities successfully. Or is a continuing trend going to be that we're going to see fewer and fewer and fewer individuals here who need help? Those questions haven't been answered here as far as I'm concerned. Are we going to build a facility that in 20 years we're going to say we don't need it all anymore? Or are we going to build a facility that doesn't have the high-tech capabilities these people really need? So I think they're talking about getting more information. I don't think we can get that information to us in a week and a half or 2 weeks. This may be something we need to look at pretty carefully in 09, get a lot more information about where they really want to go, what this population looks like, what the population size is going to be in 10, 15, 20 years. If you can predict that, you may not be able to. But I don't see the information we need to make a decision here about building essentially a new facility for the blind and for the impaired in hearing, with what's happening in the real world out there. This is a model that was put together in 1800s and has continued on through and has real value. The question is, what's that value like going to be in the next 10, 15, or 20 years? And I don't hear that being asked. And it's very concerning to me that the parents were asked and the students were asked, what do you need to make you an individual who can sustain themselves as much as possible in the world outside of the environment of a school for the blind, a school for the deaf?
Thank you, Senator. Senator Johnson.
I guess the corollary to that is that if this same amount of money were applied in a different delivery method, provide the services, use the construction money, but provide the services entirely differently. I don't know if that's even an option. How many kids do you prognosticate?
co-chair Senator Johnson, right now we're talking about perhaps 54 or 60 kids that have multiple disabilities. Very few of them have just a vision or hearing, vision or blind. They have other disabilities as well. When we asked the districts, the intent was, what does the special education team, who includes the parent, how do they make the decision that the child goes to Salem to the special school, or how do they make the decision to stay in the district? And those are the reasons for some of the questions. And the distance is one of them. The challenge of placing a kid in Salem when you live in John Day is a question for some people, or in Nissa. And what are the services? And I think when we did the first phase of the study, we included parents, we included service providers, we included some people from this committee, and had a long conversation about who were the kids that are over time were being best served in that school versus what they used to be served like 20, 30 years ago. And that's why the survey did not come back as a big surprise. We still need some kind of services to get kids ready for functional and successful adult living. And some of those kids have multiple disabilities, and is it best to do that? We have some needs for some short-term training, and I always use the example of mobility training. If you do your mobility training in Salem, but you live in John Day, you have to do new mobility training because it's a little different. And yet, if the transition is a plan for that child to continue to live in Salem and do a job here, that's when mobility training should occur. And so we did have some of that well before these conversations started with a different study committee. And so I agree with you about the numbers and the trends, I think, and we are serving more of these kids successfully in the local school community. That's why the numbers are down. But also the types of kids going there are the ones that school teams, including the parent, make a decision that it's the best place for that intensive service.
One more follow-up, Senator. One of the dangers of us acting as a committee of the whole is that some of us haven't heard this discussion at all, and we're coming to it fresh and dragging everybody along with while we ask questions, so I apologize. But in your modeling, did you look at any other partnerships that already exist where these 60 young people could be served, but could be served in an existing, say, 501c3 or any of the services provided at OHSU? So instead of, and there may be a whole universe out there that I don't know, but instead of creating a new facility here in Salem, if something already existed that you could just graft this population onto, and use the money to help support that ongoing mission.
Co-chair Senator Johnson, we did have that conversation. We not only looked within our own partnerships, we looked across the states, all the states in the nation, about what creative activities and partnerships that they had. And we had conversations of, do we close the school completely and not provide any services? The issue would become one of, do then we have to, at some point in time, contract with a special school in Washington and pay tuition because we don't have the option. And those are just questions about the more severely handicapped kids, particularly who also were vision impaired or blind. Thank you.
Madam Chair,
yes,
I don't want to have the committee left with the impression that the surveys that we've done thus far are all the surveys that we're going to do. One of the recommendations from the site panel was that we continue to gather input from stakeholders on program design and delivery structure, and we fully intend to do that. We know this is just an update to you. We know by no means are we done and ready to go forward with an RFP process, and that's why we're here to ask you to bear with us while we gather more information through this RFI process and other processes, because we are trying to be very thoughtful and deliberative. And I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, are aware this is not just a business decision. There are a lot of emotions involved in the stakeholders of the Oregon School for the Deaf and as well as the Oregon School for the Blind. And while maybe theoretically it'd be easy to say, let's just look at the bottom line, the reality is there are a lot of emotions involved.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson brought up a very good point that the full committee, not everyone, has had an opportunity to have access or to know the studies, the details, the reports. It may be well to have a copy of the report that was done in the interim, and some of legislative members were part of the group that actually was involved in looking at some of the questions that are being raised here today. So I would recommend that you make that available to the committee members.
Madam Chair and Senator Winters, we will certainly do that.
Excellent idea. Thank you. What I'd like to ask Ms. McGlashan is if you could submit a brief written response to the questions that Senator Schroeder posed and to the flavor of this discussion today. Get that to us so that the committee members can have it in advance of a future re-look at this. And I would then ask my colleagues on the committee who are interested in this issue to make themselves familiar with that information before you come to committee. I'm sure that the department will be available for any follow-up questions if you have specific information that you need before that committee. Our agenda is going to be very, very busy as we move through the session, so I'd like to schedule this for a very brief 10 to 15 minute conversation, perhaps the end of next week or the first of the following week. Seeing no objections, we will close the work session with that expectation. Now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 5556 for the purpose of looking at a couple of other items for Department of Education. Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The first one is a request for the Department to increase some federal funds limitation. This, if you remember, back in October 2007, the Interim Committee actually heard their request to apply for this grant on federal. It's from the federal U.S. Department of Education. And they applied for that grant. They were given permission at that point in time, applied for that grant. They were awarded the grant. This is just giving them the limitation for it.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think your ELCO analyst has very well summed up our request. I would just add that 95% of these grant funds will be distributed to local education agencies and 5% retained within the agency to do some evaluation. There are no matching requirements for the grant or any additional staff resources needed, and thank you for considering our request.
Oh, yeah.
Your LFO analyst is distributing to you some information Senator Gordley requested at the October meeting, and that would be the percentage of highly qualified teachers for those schools that would be receiving the grant funds. The end of your comments? That is. Thank you, Vice Chair Nicholson.
Thank you. As the committee may have noticed, both of your co-chairs are out of the room. The other vice chair is
good to work.
Vice chair is out of the room.
I got a bill I want to run through real quick for $3 million.
If you have questions, I will be taking names. Questions? And we don't even have any staff sitting here with us yet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Department of, or the Legislative Fiscal Office, let me grab my stuff. Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means amend Senate Bill 5556 to reflect an increase of $1,259,126,000 federal funds expenditure limitation for the Oregon Department of Education for a grant from the U.S. Department of Education for school improvement funds.
And I will not entertain a motion at this time. I will wait for one of the co-chairs to come back into the room. But are there any questions about LFO analysis? While this is being distributed, I think maybe the best thing to do is to move on to the next item.
I know it used to be.
Well, to describe it for us, and then we will invite the staff testimony.
Madam Chair, this is a request from the department for some other funds limitation based upon the kicker refunds, the donations that came into the Department of Revenue. The department is asking for approximately a $3 million increase and a commensurate increase in the legislatively adopted cap. The way that the bill is set up, there's the limitation for the state school fund, and then there's also an annual cap for both of the school years within that biennium. So the department is asking for an increase in their limitation, but they're also asking for the first year cap to also be raised by the like amount so that they can distribute those funds during the current school year.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, I've been filling in momentarily.
Not a lot done in a moment.
We have not taken any action on the first item under Senate Bill 5556, Federal Funds Expenditure Limitation.
Okay.
We have heard testimony, and we're on the second piece.
Okay.
We're ready to take staff testimony on the second item there.
We'll take them both as a work item, or as a vote. Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Again, for the record, I'm Sue McGlashan with the Department of Education, and I don't have any additional comments. I think your staff covered this very well, and we just want to thank you for considering our request.
Discussion, Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Schumer. Mr. Question, in view of the fact that the K-12 budget was increased substantially, and in view of the fact that we're looking at a flat budget projection or perhaps even a decreasing budget projection, why is it that the department wishes to distribute this money at this time as opposed to perhaps holding it in for a time where we might need it more?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, we believe that it's the intent of those taxpayers who donated their kicker refunds to the state school fund that those refunds be distributed to the local education agencies as soon as we possibly can, and so we're just trying to meet that intent.
Thank you.
Further discussion, Senator Bates.
Chair, this may not be relevant, but I've had numerous constituents tell me that their kicker refund didn't come to them because there was a problem with electronic filing, and they're a little upset. Okay.
I don't know if ODE would have to
answer. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, we're happy to
say what I'm saying is before we spend the money, let's make sure we've got the money.
I think that when the Department of Revenue comes in, we can chat with them about that.
I'm just concerned with that.
That's fair.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, if I might clarify, in our write-up to you, our letter to the co-chairs, actually, we did give you a little bit of an update on that situation. And the Department of Revenue had actually transferred to us $6.8 million. And when people started complaining that they had not intended for their kicker donations to go to the state school fund, we transferred back, based on the Department of Revenue's best estimate, $3.8 million. And as of January 29th, what they told us is that they had received over 1,400 claims by taxpayers. And of those 1,400, they had processed 1,200. But by processed, I mean 800 they had denied for a variety of reasons, because perhaps it was clear that the person had checked the box. Mm-hmm. 400, they actually had issued refunds back to the taxpayers, and those refunds totaled $400,000. And so they have had, at that time, another 200 to process, and then the taxpayers had until February 1st to file their claims. So they're not thinking that much more of the $3.4 million that they haven't refunded to taxpayers will actually go back to them, and it will come back to the Department of Education, and we would distribute that in the 08-09 school year, with your permission, of course.
Let's not dwell on the kicker. There's a different question, I think.
Different question.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Fletcher.
Yes,
sir. Just curious about the distribution plan. How are the monies to be distributed?
Mr. Chair and Representative Edwards, this goes through the statutory formula, so it's distributed just like any other money that the legislature provides to the department to distribute to schools.
Okay, that's what I figured. Okay, thanks.
Okay. Further discussion? Mr. Hill?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. LFO recommends that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means amend Senate Bill 5556 to reflect an increase of $3,005,438 other funds expenditure limitation for the Oregon Department of Education for the State School Fund. LFO also recommends that the bill be amended to reflect an increase of $3,005,438 in expenditure cap for the 2007-2008 school year.
Thank you. Budget Management.
Madam Chair, Jim Carboni with Budget Management Division. Budget Management Division does request your approval of this item.
Thanks. Do I have a motion?
I move that recommendation.
Okay, so the motion is on the second item. We'll take separate motions on these two items. Okay. further discussion on the motion?
Second item.
Senator Bates?
Madam Chair, I'm going to be a no. I still think there's problems here. I've got constituents ready to go to court in this issue. They are hopping mad. They think Bedard Revenue has treated them unfairly. They think that there's been an error of some kind. I'm not sure the money's there. And I'm just going to let you know how I feel about it. So I'll be a no on this right now.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Would you give a different description for second item so that we're clear?
Okay. Mr. Hill.
Madam Co-Chair, this is the item relating to the other funds expenditure limit increase for the state school fund.
Follow up.
Did that help?
The reason I asked that question is I don't think that pertains to Senator Bates' comment. I think his comments are to the one we discussed before that. For the one point...
Is for the grant from the federal government?
I think the piece Senator Bates is speaking of is the $1.26 million the school improvement fund transfer.
If I might, I think Senator Bates is actually discussing this one. This is the one that the kicker checks for, but this is $3 million that would go to the state school fund. It is the kicker fund recheck issue.
Further discussion? Objections? Senator Bates? Senator Whitsitt? Representative Hanna? I think the motion still carries. Motion carries. Mr. Co-Chair?
I move the first, did Alfie give a recommendation on the first one when I was
yes,
out of the room?
Yes, but we haven't heard from budget.
So then
I'm sorry, budget and management. My error. The first one. Let me guess.
Budget management recommends approval.
Excellent, Mr. Carboni. Now, Mr. Chair, co-chair.
Yes, I move that the Arlington Department of Education receive its $1.26 million federal funds expenditure limitation for the grant that was awarded by the U.S. Department of Education for school improvement funds.
Well done.
Uneducable.
Discussion. Objection. Motion carries. Thanks. So we will close the work session on Senate Bill 5556 and open an informational meeting featuring the Department of Education.
Madam Chair, as we're making the transition,
would you please, Senator, yes.
Make an introduction. In the audience this afternoon is the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Urban League of Portland, Mr. Marcus Mundy. And Marcus also serves on the Oregon Health Fund Board, and it's just a delight to have him in the Capitol today, and welcome.
Welcome, Mr. Mundy. Thank you. Hope we're showing our best interest, if not our best understanding of some of these issues. Good to have you with us. Ms. McGlashan.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, again, I'm Sue McGlashan with the Department of Education, and Dr. Latini and I will now provide you with an update on the Oregon pre-kindergarten program. And as you know, the 2007 legislature appropriated $39 million general fund to expand the Oregon pre-kindergarten, also known as the OPK program. And of this amount, $14 million was directly appropriated to the department for the first year of the biennium to begin the expansion. The remaining $25 million was established as a special purpose appropriation in the emergency fund for the second year of the biennium. And prior to your allocation to the department of that $25 million, we were to come back to report on the results of the first year expansion, plans for the use of the second year funding, and then updates on related federal funding. And I'll just briefly talk about the expansion dollars and then turn it over to Dr. Latini. For the first year of the expansion, the $14 million resulted in an additional 1,732 children served, and this raised the percentage of children served from about 57% to 67%. For the second year expansion, the $25 million would allow continuation of those slots added this year, as well as the addition of 1,350 new slots, and this will bring the percentage of children served to an estimated 75%. So I'm now going to ask Dr. Latini to provide you with more details on the program, the status, more detailed status of the expansion plans, and then an update on federal funding and other federal issues.
Nancy Lieutenant for the record, Assistant Superintendent of the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. Give you a brief context so you know about the program. The Oregon Legislature enacted the Oregon Head Start Pre-Kindergarten Program in 1987. We wanted to provide a comprehensive child development and school readiness program for Oregon's poorest and neediest 3- and 4-year-old children and their families. At that time, the legislature determined that a comprehensive program rather than a single isolated school experience alone would reap more benefits for the families as well as the children. So in other words, we mirrored the program of federal Head Start program. By doing this, the OPK program is expected to administer in Oregon a program that's similar to the requirements and the program standards for the federal Head Start program. And by aligning both of them, we've been able to leverage funds for teacher training, for more common referrals, and for looking at things in a more economic way. Programs are monitored in a similar way as the federal Head Start program as well. These programs are designed to meet the individual needs of the students and also looking at the instructional planning, but also to look at the needs of families so we make proper referrals to social service agencies as they might need them. In phase one, as you just heard, what we did was we had, because of the way the funding came to us, we were able to stagger how we started this program. So in the phase one, what we did was allow those current programs that we had to first have the first chance at saying, are you able to expand? You need to expand. And in order to get any of that money in a non-competitive way, they still had to write a program to say, we can add X number of children, and this is how we can do it, and we have the infrastructure to do that. At that point, then, we projected that we would probably add 1,626 slots for children. And in reality, what ended up, the good news was we were able to add 1,732 slots because these current programs had the infrastructure in place. We didn't have to spend money on startup costs in that way. They essentially had the space for the children and most of the teachers already that were there.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. If I want to ask about that number, the 1,732. We have a chart on the back of the expansion report that tells us what that expansion looks like in each of the counties, but not reflected is what is the remaining need. We know that we're moving now up to, 75%. If I may make a comment about that, it's amazing to me that a program that we made a commitment to starting in 1987 has taken us 20 years, to creep up to 75%, which says something about our values and priorities. But with that said, could you talk about the remaining need in each of the counties?
Actually, co-chairs and Senator Gordley, I did ask that question of staff. They've been working on it by county to get the percentage of need. They felt not comfortable sharing that because it hasn't all been verified, but within a week we should be able to have that back to you, so you'll see the same thing with the percentage of needs on it. We'll get that to you in a week.
We're just starting to verify that, actually, Ms. Latini, if you have that information available for everybody.
Absolutely, we'll send it.
Thank you. On this same subject, I don't know how you determine what constitutes the need. For example, foster children, it has been my experience in talking to constituents that foster children, once they're taken out of a bad situation, they're placed with foster parents, and the qualifications change by virtue of the fact that they're now in a family with a certain economic level and a stable domestic situation. And so when Senator Gordley talks about unmet need, I'd like to know the definitional criteria for unmet need, because it seems to me that denying foster kids slots in Head Start and some of these early enrichment by virtue of their change in status is just patently unfair. So I'd like to make sure that we know how you define unmet need.
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, we do have that, and it's very specific by county, and county teams make those decisions about what would rise to the highest needs, and we can get that to you to define that. We'll put that along with the chart.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good discussion. Any other comments? To Representative Galizia?
Yeah, just on the same topic, just to be sure, in terms of the numbers, when you talk about percentage, It's always referred to 80% is considered fully funding. So is this, when you say went from 57 to 67, that means 67% of total, not 67% of the 80% that's considered fully funding Head Start, correct?
Mm-hmm. Co-chairs, a representative from Israel, you're accurate and correct.
Good clarification. Follow up or not? Okay. Further discussion, Senator Gordley.
Just one additional brief point. Looking back in time, we do have or did have an Oregon benchmark for the Oregon pre-kindergarten program, which said that we would serve all of the eligibles by, I believe it was 2005. That was the benchmark.
Thank you. Further discussion or questions? Paul, thank you very much. Please. Senator Carter, yes.
I was waiting for an answer. Did we reach the benchmark by 2005?
Co-chairs, Senator Carter, no, we did not.
That's right.
And we're still not there.
I just didn't want to leave it hanging out there, because it would appear to me that the department needs to get back to this committee in terms of why, what was the barriers, what were the barriers as a state. Putting in as much money as we have in a pre-K program, but we did not reach our benchmarks, and what do we need to do in order to reach those benchmarks? Because it appears to me that we're throwing good money after either bad planning or our inability to reach it, or we're not giving enough resources. I want to know what the case is.
The latter.
I'm going to be careful with that question.
I think we have to look in the mirror, Senator. This is one we look in the mirror on.
Yeah, then we need to look in the mirror.
Senator Winters?
Yeah, I have a question in looking at the expansion slots and in looking for some counties, and my county's one of them, received 367 slots. And yet, if I look at Tillamook or Umatilla, they received zero slots. And can you tell me what was the criteria why we have, particularly if looking at Head Start, Head Start suggests that the population that's enrolled in Head Start are those from both the social economical level that's needy, and so I didn't. And I'm looking at other counties mm-hmm. where we know you have high unemployment rates. I mean, some of those issues. So can you please help me with why there's zeros in some? And
yes, I can. Actually, because of the lack of capacity or space, they might have needed more time. For the phase one, they had very few months, actually, to put a plan together and get started. And these people will probably, if they have more children and have enough children, as you say, in counties that you mentioned, they will, that they would have to be building that capacity and planning and can get into the second phase.
A follow-up question. Is the department assisting them in order to develop capacity?
Co-chair, Senator Winters, as best we can, yes, we are, as far as telling them what we see in other places, how people have both capacity, whether it's space, whether it's finding the teachers, whether it's getting the families to be referred and actually active in the programs.
Thank you. Good discussion.
Thank you very much.
To phase two?
Yes, please. The second year of expansion, the remaining funds will be used, awarded in a competitive application, and this is giving the current programs that did not expand. It will give opportunities for new people. We sent the notices out in November to community-based organizations, tribal governments, institutions of higher learning, public schools, and ESDs to let them know this process was happening. We had a bidders conference to help people who were interested in applying that hadn't before, so we could help them make applications. Those applications are due to the department on March 10th, and at that time we'll have a panel of impartial reviewers reviewing them to make the selections. This coming year, then, the additional $25 million will continue to serve the 1,732 and hopefully add approximately 1,350 more children to this program. And as you heard, it'll raise the access at that point to approximately 75%, still not the 80, but 75%.
Thank you. Discussion. Senator Johnson.
Sorry to be so annoying, but I'm really struggling with this. When I look at the counties where there was zero capacity added, some of those are the counties that have struggled the hardest in economic downturns. They've been the natural resource dependent counties, and I know because one of them is mine, they have virtually no capacity to develop sites on the ground. They don't have a tradition of philanthropy in some cases, and they don't have capacity because they've struggled so hard. And it seems, I'm trying to reconcile that some of the kids that need these services the most end up in counties where, if I understood you correctly, the department says go forth and create capacity, but you don't give them any help. And I'm trying to figure out how some of these poor little counties, Wheeler, Hope, Sherman, what's the expectation that they'll ever make the grade?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, the help that I do believe our department and our staff can provide them are things like, is there space in your school? Is there space someplace? We have the money to provide this, if you can find the teachers, to put the plan together so that we know that if the children are going to come, there's a place for them to be and that they can get the services they need. We did go out to one of the outlying, our staff went out twice, actually, to one of the counties that's on here to help to form there was a preschool program, and they really didn't know that they wanted these kids in this program as part of it. And we went out several times, and it happened to be in a county where there were families that were used to being together, and this was something new for them. And so we went out, and staff talked to them about how this could enhance a program. And at this point, they're looking at it and considering it. One more.
Yes, Senator. So if a county came to you and they said, we have excess capacity in an underused grade school, we've identified teachers who meet the minimum qualifications to instruct, would you provide them with the money to pay those teachers and help them with other technical requirements that they might need, furnishings or educational toys or whatever else they needed? Do you have money to do that?
This is where this money comes from, is paying the teachers and the structures.
Okay.
Senator Bates.
Madam Chair, exactly. I think the question we're bumping up against here is going to be answered by what Senator Gordley asked for, and that was what the percentage of need still was out there. Hmm. And just roughly looking at this highly populated city-based counties are getting 20, 30, 40% bumps in the capacity. Rural counties are often getting zero or less than 10%. But these figures may not be complete, and what we need to see is what the need is. And I think that's what we're talking about here. There seems to be a significant maldistribution in the funds we made available for the expansion of Head Start. This was not designed to do that. Designed to help all children in the state of Oregon. And this may be misleading us. And this may not be what the real situation is. So I'll be looking forward to seeing what the need still is out there. That'll be probably more accurate for what we're looking at, but it's a little concerning what I'm seeing here.
Senator, I'm not sure I read the numbers the same way you do.
I may not be reading properly. I'd be first to say
I'm looking to
understand the program.
Yeah, I think we need to understand it a little better, and I don't know that it can categorize it along the lines you described. If I'm looking at Baker County with a 1/3 increase, Clatsop County with a 70-some percent increase, and some other, Benton County with only a 1.5% increase, I don't know that it divides that neatly between rural and urban. Clearly, there are differences among the counties, but I'm not sure we can lay it to that issue.
And further discussion, Madam Chair? Just a brief follow-up. But I do think it's important to know that the department, where we have counties, particularly where we're looking at counties that are depressed and have, you know, some real economic issues, that the department is using the resources either to encourage and plus to enable those counties to access this expansion. That was my point, that it's not just enough to say capacity, but to assure that the department is working with the various counties to get them to the place where they do have capacity.
And the resources available for that kind of planning are not just the department, but nonprofits, counties, school districts, ESDs. I hope we are not expecting the department to do this
on its own, but to be available to assist and guide and provide additional technical services for those counties or school districts that don't have the infrastructure to do it themselves. Further discussion? Representative Nathan Sinclair.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. There's been a lot of question about basically how to interpret the numbers. So I have a request for not only this kind of chart, but other sorts of statistical data that you might be bringing us in the future. Raw numbers are sometimes extremely useful, but to tell a story quickly, this is not as useful for me as ratios or percentages or other kinds of charts. It's hard for me to compare, for example, Hood River County and Jackson County and Lane County. To what extent are they comparable or not comparable? I don't know how the numbers here compare to a percentage of children in a certain age group in the whole county. I don't know if 42 is an appropriate number compared to someone else's 580, where they're the same number of children or a vastly different number of children in the age group. So that's one of the things that makes it hard for me to interpret raw numbers, unless we also have the other sort of stuff that helps us see what is the trend. Is the situation getting better or worse, and how does one county compare to another? Are they all on a par or are they not? So that's just a little request for the future. Thank you.
Thanks.
If I may, Madam Chair, I think this is just a problem between committee of the whole.
Yep.
I think it was brought up earlier. You know, we're just not as knowledgeable. I think the numbers make some sort of sense to those who've served on education. And I don't think this is anything unusual or new or some nefarious plot here, and I think we all realize that. But good questions, and maybe this will inform the subcommittee when it reconvenes it. Maybe hopefully after special session, certainly
809. Mr. Kocher, I can see the folks who want to send more money over to public education in Oregon. I think that would be useful.
Yes.
Excellent discussion. I think it does point out that those of us who haven't served on this subcommittee have some learning to do. It slows down the committee of the whole, but it also tends to bring us all up to a better level of understanding, and so there are trade-offs with this structure. We're practicing at it. Let's move on to the next item, please.
The last part of this presentation.
Oh, sorry. Senator Latini.
You asked for an update on federal funding for Head Start. And it's not very good news. It's not very positive, and I'll just let you know where we stand with it. The allocations that Oregon received this year for Head Start for the first time did not cover the staff position or the required travel for that person. And so we're needing to use some of our operations general fund to help to cover that at this point. That shows you what kind of money that we were getting. The money that the programs get that does not come through the Department for Federal Head Start, it goes directly to the programs, is totally flat funded. I called the regional office today to ask them exactly what Oregon got, exactly the same amount of money that they got last year. And so the programs that are running Head Start programs are not getting any increase. The other issue right now is the concern with the Head Start reauthorization. And we're all very happy that the reauthorization occurred, but with it came several mandates and no increase in funding. And there's been a pushback nationally, and our own Ron Herndon, who's in charge of the Albina Head Start and is also a board chair at the National Head Start Association, is one of the people helping to lead that charge. I'm going to give you a couple examples of what some of the unfunded mandates for this program for young children are, just so you get a feel for the struggle that we're going to be going through. Increased credentials for teachers, family service workers, and other staff, which will translate into increased pay for these people as well. New employee standards and training, easing the entry standard from 100% to 130% poverty level would increase the number of children available for the program that are eligible and yet not the money to serve them. The priority of enrollment of homeless children, excellent and definitely needed. But again, it's the point of not giving any more additional money when you're not serving the children that need to be served. The mandatory enrollment of children with disabilities and the extensive new record keeping that they're going to have to do. And so just to give you some examples of the struggles that the Head Start program is going through right now with that reauthorization. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Representative Hanner.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'll be brief. On this page, when we look at the cost for the first year, the $14 million was dedicated to adding 1,732 families. And so, I mean, just doing rude math, just over $8,000 per child for that program. We went to the second year, added $25 million. That's covering both the first year add and the second year. So it went from costing $8,000 per child down to around $5,200 per child.
That's
not it? And what am I missing there?
I did the same, if I may, Madam Chair. I did the math. I get the same $8,000. 1732 plus 1350, you know, $25 million divided by 3,000 students was the same as 14 divided by 1732 or whatever it was.
I don't know where it had that number divided by 25.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Phil, maybe you want to explain. Are you good on this, Representative Hanner?
I just wanted to understand. Well, talk about, you know, that the current programs, you know, that the infrastructure and design was a heavier cost up front in the first year, and so it looked like there was going to be efficiencies, but that didn't really pan out, it doesn't appear.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I hope to clarify, the existing infrastructure is already there at the programs. They leveraged that by using space that they had, equipment that they had. So it's really not a dollar amount attached to that. Representative Hanna, I thought I heard you say the number 5,218. That's actually the number of children served as a result of the first year expansion.
The total number of children.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good. Thanks for the clarification. Further discussion or questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Just an observation. To truly understand the power and promise of Head Start, whether we call it the Oregon Pre-K program or the federal Head Start program, we have only to go, well, I think it's a little less than a mile down the street to the Oregon State Prison and see what happens when we don't make an investment on the front end. What we know from longitudinal studies that have looked at the Head Start program is that it's the best prevention investment we can make.
A very good reminder, Senator. Further comment or discussion? Thank you. Are we acknowledging anything or just getting an update? Excellent. Mr. Hill?
Sorry, Madam Co-Chair, the next item is an update on the Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Program. There is also a special appropriation in the emergency fund of approximately $6.1 million for second-year funding.
Ms. McGlashan.
Madam Chair, thank you, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Sue McGlashan, and Dr. Latini and I will now provide you with an update on the Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Program, and we also refer to this as EIECSE. And this is a program that serves children birth to school age who have disabilities or developmental delays that could result in a disability, and the program also provides services to their families. And the intended outcome of the services is to improve school readiness by reducing the impact of the disability or the developmental delay through a variety of interventions and family supports. And as Mr. Hill mentioned, there is about a $6.1 million special purpose appropriation in the emergency fund for second-year caseload growth, and we were to report back to you on that caseload growth and federal funding for the program. And the handout that you've received has a graph on the back that shows the growth in the program over 4 years. And as you can tell, and as expected, we are experiencing growth in the program over the last year. The legislatively adopted budget was built using an assumed caseload growth of 4.5% per year. We believe we are close to that growth rate, and we may even be a little bit over that. But, and I certainly don't want to add to your frustration level about not having enough information today, but we use the March child count when we're calculating the growth year to year, and right now we only have child counts through January. So it's a little early for us to tell whether we are on track, and of course we are happy to provide you with additional information once we get that March count. So I'm going to turn the presentation over to Dr. Latina now, and she's going to give you some more background on the program, a description of other work that these programs have had to take on without additional funding, the results of an efficiency study that has been conducted on the program, and then updates on federal funding for the program.
Nancy Latina, Department of Education. The EIECSE program was enacted in 1989. The Oregon legislature transferred that program from the Department of Human Services to the Department of Education, and that was beginning in 1992. This program is funded by both state general funds and federal funds and a limited amount of Medicaid, which I'll talk to you about later, Medicaid reimbursement. Programs are subjected to all of the monitoring requirements of the federal special education laws, and they're monitored at the same time as our staff goes out to monitor the school districts. There are 9 ESD contracts that provide services to these children with significant developmental delays or other disabilities that we know will impact education in the future. To name a few, speech and language, mental retardation, severe physical disabilities, kids with severe medical issues, autism, for just naming a few of them. The ESD sometimes subcontract then services to assure that these services are provided in the community sites and in home for the very youngest children. The overall goals of this program, these are kids that are really, if you've been identified them that young, you know they have pretty significant disabilities. They're not just kids that may not be walking and they need to catch up. We're really trying to assist the family to understand what that disability will have as a potential impact on education in the future. We're helping the family to increase their capacity to support that child in the future in education, and we're also trying to improve the developmental and school readiness for that child specifically. We're also trying then to create that community connection for families. These are families that are going to always need some referrals in the community for support as well as the school. We're trying to get those started early so that they're comfortable with what they need to be doing in the future. The federal funds come in 2 streams, and that's why people sometimes get that real confused with the EI, Early Intervention, ECSE, the education, Special Education Program. The Birth to 3 program is the Early Intervention, and that's one separate federal fund stream, and it focuses on children birth up to age 3. The early child and special education are the toddlers from age 3 to school age, which is usually 5. The federal program is mandated is the 3 to school age program and state mandate for the birth to 3 program. Oregon, because both of these programs are in the Department of Education, operate a seamless program for both. Families don't know where their funding is coming from. They don't need to know. It's certainly more efficient for the families to stay with one teacher than to say, this teacher is funded here and this teacher is funded here. And it definitely is more efficient for our programs as far as administratively staffing them. So we deal with that as a truly seamless system, and other states have been asking us now about that structure because they see it benefiting families much more than having 2 separate systems. You read enough about the numbers at this point, and if you have questions, we'll be glad to answer those. But what I wanted to do is share with you some of the other tasks that the program has been required to take on and some of the challenges that we're having. And the first program we talk about is it impacts workload for teachers, but it does not show up in caseload all the time. And this is the Child Abuse and Prevention and Treatment Act, CAPTA, which is a federal law. And this federal law requires that the Department of Human Services refer all victims of substantiated child abuse under the age of 3 to the Early Intervention Program for assessment. These numbers are continuing to grow, as you can guess, in Oregon. It places a significant impact on the staff and, of course, on programs. And we have so much staff to do assessments for these children as well as making proper referrals and also serving the children that we're getting from other places. Last week I learned, and you wouldn't be surprised, that these numbers are growing, so the referrals will be growing. What we're doing now is working with the Department of Human Services to try to figure out the best way to stay in the letter and the spirit of the law to make sure we these kids are cared for and we do the right thing, but also to make sure that we both jointly do this work and plan for these families. And we'll keep you posted on how that's going. Other states are doing it successfully. We're hoping that we can model some of those. The Medicaid funding, I think every time I come to talk to you, I talk about the difficulty of accessing that money. Well, it's been made even more difficult by Congress voting in now a major change in the reimbursement options for school programs. The final rules that have been passed now prevent school officials from reimbursing for certain functions, Medicaid functions called administrative claiming. And these are administrative costs for arranging for services for Medicaid-eligible children, including outreach, including transportation to and from school where they get their Medicaid services, and also for use of mobility training for vision-impaired children and other direct services that are offered at the school. Rather, now under the new federal rules, these children would have to be transported to a hospital or some other official site to get their medical services as opposed to getting them on site at the school. These rules are final, but they don't go into effect until July 1 of 2008. So what's going on right now is there are several large school districts in the state and state and country and over 40 national organizations that are trying to reach out to Congress to tell them what a devastating effect this may be having on the services to these children. For our EIECSE program, if you recall when we've talked about this before, as they get reimbursed for Medicaid, they use that money for things like teacher training, if they need to hire a part-time staff for a medically fragile child for a part-time, specialized equipment, so that the funding that you provide to them can go for the direct services to the children and to the families. And we'll keep you informed how this is going to play out as well. The federal funding for special education didn't come out as well as expected either. The funds for the 3 to 5 year old program right now, we see in the latest official chart, a 1.8 reduction from last year. In the program for birth to 3, realized a 0.2% cut. We don't really see that improving. I saw an unofficial chart yesterday that said flat funding, which also would equate to some kind of a cut because of the rising costs. The efficiency study. At the end of the 2005 legislative session, the department embarked on a formal study of these programs and also the regional program for special education to determine what, if anything, could be learned about better and more efficient systems. You have an executive summary and the final report. We can give you a full report if you're interested. You're going to see that the pages aren't consistent, and the reason they're not is I looked at the executive summary and it didn't say enough, so I went to the back of the report and pulled out the specific recommendations that were made so that you would have those as well. I'm going to highlight just a few of what we're looking at right now for efficiencies. We're looking at examining ways to enhance the placement options for these children when they go into daycares and places so that we can reduce some costs. We're looking at enhancing the public outreach as far as making the proper referrals. And we're also trying to streamline any data collection that we're asking programs to do, make sure that we're not asking for information that's not required for some kinds of reports. The other recommendations for future study, we're going to be looking at bolstering parent support. They came out loud and clear that parents want to network with each other, and I don't think we're doing a very good job of that. We can do better. Easing the bid process for these 9 contractors, making it continue to be competitive, but also not making people repeat every 2 years the same report and do all that paperwork if we don't have to do that. And the development of state benchmarks for the program, specifically to this program. We have a lot of groups looking at this information. Among them is the Special Education Director Advisory. We have a Special Education Finance Advisory, also our State Advisory for Special Education, and then the State and Agency Coordinating Council, which focuses on early childhood. As you can see, we have our work cut out for us. We're going to try to take all of this retooling at a higher level, and we'll keep you posted on how efficient we can be, more efficient we can become. I'd be happy to answer any questions about early childhood special education.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Winters.
Thank you. Just one question, and it's a question about collaboration and how involved are the commissions on children and families with the department, particularly as we talk about early intervention and the abuse neglect assessment program, since all 36 counties are responsible for actually coming up with local plans to address some of these issues.
Co-Chair, Senator Winters, we're very excited about the close relationship that we have with the commissions and local commissions as well as at the state level. And we meet on a regular basis. I think there's a early childhood summit that's coming up in March. We're all collaborating on that to make sure all the messages are the same. And so we are working closely and making sure we don't duplicate efforts, but also make sure that we can attend to the people who need our help services.
Just a quick comment, because it was mentioning the growth in abuse, neglect, and that intervention with the assessment centers. What wasn't stated is that one of the causes of that child abuse and neglect figures going up is this drug problem that we have called meth. I had to put that on record, because sometimes we forget that this body is dealing with those issues as well, and particularly the families that are connected with those, and the treatment that's needed and necessary.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. How many children that access this program would be in the same universe of the school for the blind or the school for the deaf? I mean, are children accessing this any evidence of your decrease in population in either one of those two specialized schools?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, that's a very good question. I'm not sure it's the program in itself, but the technology and what our school districts have become more, as children learn what they need and school districts become more capable of serving them, they stay in their home community, parents do not want them traveling. I think that at this point, the preschool programs and up to age five are the responsibility of the state and are in the early childhood programs. They certainly could, at school age, make referrals. The young children we're not seeing being referred to the state schools from preschool to kindergarten.
So if I'm a parent with a child that would be eligible to, let's say, be in the school for the blind, but they also then could qualify for this program and I could opt one or the other?
What occurs in special education is something called an individual education plan team that includes the parent. And the group of people get together and decide what are the services the child needs. And we start with the closest to home. Can we deliver all these services there? And then we go on to the most restrictive. And that team makes that decision together. It's not a shopping that you get to go here or there or here. We try to hopefully stay at the least restrictive first. We have the regional programs who also offer services to the preschool program, which are the eight regions that serve those local school districts. And they do serve preschool children as well. I know that's confusing.
That's fine. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Senator Carter, you have a question?
Thank you. When you say we think, Dr., the Medicaid billing, is it because Medicaid was paying behind the time? We need to coordinate better the dollars from Medicaid versus those dollars from the state. Elaborate on that a little more, please.
Co-Chair Senator Carter, what happened was Medicaid funding, as you know, was all over the map, and especially for schools. They conducted a study that a government accountability office, mm-hmm. and what they found were, and I do particularly do not believe it happened in Oregon, but they did find that there was a lot of misuse of claiming of funds for schools, and so they decided this was one of the best ways to contain it. They will save millions of dollars by doing this. What comes out at the end and the other side is children having to leave school to get services, which is something that the beauty of having people at the school do the services is what the question is for kids with disabilities in particular.
Thank you, Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Ms. Lutini, I would like to see the performance measures for the parent support piece of the program that you're describing. I'm looking at recommendation number 5 on page 44 and the need to bolster parent support. What's indicated here is that Oregon falls down when it comes to parental involvement, and that's not because there are parents not wanting to be involved. We put up barriers that make it very difficult. So I would like to know, what outcomes are we expecting? What are the performance measures? What kind of timelines are we looking at so that we can move forward aggressively in getting parents involved with the PI UCSE program.
Co-Chair Senator Gardley, that will be done. Thank you, Clarity.
Thank you.
Okay. And no further discussion? Thank you both. Last item on today's agenda. Ms. McGorrison?
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Bring us home.
For the record. I'm Sue McGlashan with the Oregon Department of Education, and Brian Fork from the Oregon Youth Authority has joined us, and we're here today to provide you, as directed by you in the 2007 legislative session, with an update on the issue of services provided to youth in the Youth Corrections Education Program, and we also refer to that as YSEPS, who have already received a high school diploma or are 21 years of age or older. And the legislature in House Bill 5019 reduced the second year expenditure limitation for this program by $2.7 million, pending updated information on the number of youth served in this category and the types of programs available. In the interest of time, I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to Dr. Latini and Brian. Thank you.
If we don't give a little background on Nancy Latini, Department of Education, so that we have the context for this program. The Department of Education contracts with local education entities, school districts, and ESDs for the education services for youth that are in correctional facilities that are operated by the Oregon Youth Authority. The services offered in this program, which is the Youth Education Corrections Program, we call YSEP, include special education, general education, and transition programs. In 2005, shortly before the 2005 session, the department discovered or looked at a certain group of students and wondered why we were funding these students out of the state school fund. These were students who were already secured their regular high school diploma, and they may have been over 21. Both of those do not fit into the definition of state school fund as far as the definition for students. So at the end of the 2005 legislative session, legislator directed the department, through budget note, to work with OIA and some other stakeholders to take a look and study this targeted population. The committee was formed, and they issued a report that included recommendations for services. They confirmed that the definition of student under the state school fund certainly did not apply to this group, and they further recommended that either the funding for this group be in a separate pot, or you change the definition in the state school fund to include this pot. Students. They also then recommended that ODE retain the educational responsibility for this group of students, which again was another question from that budget note about these kids are older, they have high school diplomas, should the Department of Education have it? At that time, the committee recommended it stay with the department. And then relative to the education services, they recommended that this group of students who had their high school diploma, were over 21, should focus on career and technical education, transition services, post-education opportunities, and college readiness and skill development, those things that young people need as they become adults. When we were designing the separate program, it became evident in some of the situations that it would be best to interweave some of these services in situations where we might be serving, the same teacher could be serving both a high school student and some of these students in one of these areas in career development, for example. We also realized that we would save efficiency by having the infrastructure the same administration, payroll costs, the technology, purchasing services, all the administrative things could still be under the same umbrella as long as the programs had separated. I'm going to have Brian share some of the examples of the programs that we are starting to use and also some plans for the future. And we do have a chart with some examples of the large ones and talk about those as well.
Co-Chairs Nolan Schrader, members of the committee. My name is Brian Florek with the Oregon Youth Authority. I'm assistant director of the agency responsible for the operation of our youth correctional facilities. And I guess I'd like to start by saying that at OIA we focus our service to youth on those interventions intended to reduce the use of risk for future law violations. And the Youth Corrections Education Program is an integral part of reformation activities directed toward that goal. Each youth has an individual case plan that identifies their need for service based on a risk need assessment that you perform. A multidisciplinary team then oversees that case plan and works with the youth to address areas of risk and prepare them for transition back to the community. A youth's ability to engage in school or in work or in a combination of those two when they return to the community is a critical factor in a successful transition. And I think the Youth Corrections Education Program affords youth that opportunity to be best prepared for that transition through academic readiness, through job skill development, and support transition services related to school and to work. The authority is working with ODE and with our education contractors to create additional opportunity and economy of scale in this program by focusing youth placement and service delivery at four key locations for male offenders and two for our young women in our facility system. The youth earn diplomas as they do that, or as they complete treatment services, or as they age. The multidisciplinary team reviews those cases and recommends and implements placement decisions that allows us to target students to access the services for this older target population. I think as far as examples of the programs, clearly we have a strong post-secondary education component in several of our sites. We do vocational skill building in a variety of areas, including welding certifications. We provide cosmetology licenses. There's a strong construction and building trade program in several of our transition camp programs. And what it does is prepare these young offenders for that ability to get back in the community, engage in school, engage in work. And I think it addresses two of our key risk factors. I think the research shows us that an antisocial belief system and association with antisocial peers are two of the most predictive risk factors in the youth that we serve. So preparing them for a meaningful transition, connecting them in an academic setting or in a work setting when they return to the community, addresses both of those risk factors in a very effective way. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about that.
Thank you.
Question?
Yes, Senator Gorsuch.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon to you. Would you say that there's equity of opportunity available to young women and young men in these programs?
Co-Chair Senator Gorsuch, I think we are certainly focusing a considerable amount of energy on service to young women. I think, as you know, we're transitioning young women to a new site. They're moving to the Oak Creek facility in Albany this month, and we're working with the Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD and focusing on a broad range of opportunity in the academic setting, vocational skill building, and then connecting to the Corvallis House Transition Program, which is one of the resources we use to affect transition for the young women. To answer your question about equity, I think at McLaren, it's a bigger facility. There are certainly more physical capacity and ability to do a range of programs, but we are focusing energy and staff resource on creating that opportunity for young women in the new program at Oak Creek.
And so I want to clearly understand what you're saying. Is there equity of opportunity currently for girls, equal access to opportunities for girls?
Co-Chair Senator, I would answer yes, equity, but the programs are not mirror images of one another.
Mm-hmm.
At McLaren, certainly the focus is on certain trades and vocational skill building and other opportunities. The young women are currently housed at Hillcrest, and they have a very strong program with Willamette ESD that offers post-secondary education and also vocational skill building and transition services, but a different focus than for the male offenders.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Johnson.
Two questions. One to follow up on that. What if a young woman wants to pursue welding? Is that available? I'm just trying to think as I drive around my district and I see the signs in practically every business, welders desperately needed, what a clear pathway that is to a job, an opportunity that comes with having a job. But I guess I'm trying to nuance what Senator Gorley asked. Are the girls given sewing and the boys given welding? And I'm trying to figure out how to turn some of these young ladies loose in trades that are seriously needed.
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, I think a young woman who's interested in a trade that isn't an offering in our youth correctional facility setting, we would focus that in the transition setting. So the example would be in the Young Women's Transition Program in Corvallis. We would work to connect that young woman with a tradesperson in the community as part of the vocational experience while she is still, you know, under our supervision in a facility program. But the breadth of programming available for the 65 young women in youth correctional facility, currently I don't believe welding is an opportunity we afford them in that setting. We'd look to provide that in transition.
Just to beat this to death, could you give us a list of the offerings for the young women and the young men, just so we could have a basic idea of what is offered?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, we can do that. I don't have that list in front of me now.
I would just provide it to the professional staff and they get it out to us. I just would be curious to see what's offered for the young women in juxtaposition. The other question that I have with the chair's indulgence is, to what degree are any of your programs hooked up with any of the trades on the outside so that a young person could build towards an apprenticeship certification, for example, while they're incarcerated? Have you worked out any of those kind of cooperative agreements to have a young person come out with sufficient training that they could be accepted into an apprentice program?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, yes, we have, and those connections vary site to site. Certainly the welding program at McLaren is connected to the business community. We've made placements right from McLaren where the young people are employed at point of transition and quickly are making more than the supervisors and the instructors that taught them the skill. In our transition programs in, for example, Camp Florence, there's a strong connection there to the construction trade. The young men work with construction companies in that community. Oftentimes are building skills and a resume that makes them employable momentarily and then come back. So those connections are present, and we're working hard with ODE and with the education contractors to continue to enhance those.
Thank you. Good. Further questions, discussion? You have tried to put a lot of information in our heads today, and I hope we have absorbed a little bit of it. Thank you for your patience with us. We appreciate it.
Madam Chair,
colleagues, Ms. McGlashan, yes.
Oh, I was just going to thank you for the time. We really appreciate being able to bring these issues forward and discuss them with you.
You bet. Thank you. Colleagues, we have, as we expect to throughout this session, received substantive bills from policy committees. One was passed to us last night, and given the nature of it and the nature of our calendar, we have posted that bill for tomorrow evening, a work session at 6 o'clock. It is Senate Bill 1080. So I would ask your indulgence. We are trying to be mindful of people's calendars, but given how much attention this particular bill, which has to do with driver's licenses, had in its earlier hearing, we have to post it outside of normal hours in order to accommodate the interest in the bill. So we will have two meetings tomorrow, our normal 3:30 time slot and a 6 o'clock work session on Senate Bill 1080. And my apologies to those who have other events scheduled. We will understand if perhaps you have to be at the event you're hosting for a bit of that time, but we hope to be able to see you some of the time. Thank you. See you tomorrow. We are adjourned.